This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, our guest is Dedal McCollum, former mayor of the city of Champaign. But we're not talking about politics. Listeners may be relieved at this point in the American history to know. We're talking about something maybe even more interesting and perhaps more controversial, religion and its relation to the public schools, and a very famous case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, taken on behalf of Dedal's older brother by his mother as the plaintiff. His mother, Vashti McCollum. Welcome, Dan. Good to have you here.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here, Steve.
Now, you have an interesting relationship to this town because this case, in a sense, made Champaign-Urbana national news, maybe for the first time. I'm not sure. You're the local historian, but I would guess the town got more notoriety because of this case than perhaps anything in its history. Tell us how it got started. What was happening? What was the situation in the schools when your brother, James Terry, was just a 10-year-old?
Well, I would probably have to first say that Red Grange probably did more to more to put the town on the map than or the community on the map than the McCollum case. But in the early 1940, the then superintendent of the schools had suggested at a board meeting that perhaps to deal with the juvenile delinquency problem, which was not really identified or specified as to the extent of it, that it might be addressed by having a religious class in the schools, dealing with morals, I suppose. The board told the superintendent to look into it. A group of local ministers got together and rather aggressively worked during the summer and put together a program. It had three components. It had a Protestant one-size-fits-all type of class, a Catholic component, and a Jewish component. I don't believe that the Jewish community was really very excited about it, but according to Reverend A. Ray Cartledge, a group of Protestant business leaders got together with a group of Jewish business leaders, and they said, we'll go along with it, more or less, as Cartledge put it, on the basis of damned if they did, damned if they didn't.
Okay. So they put together what resulted in being finally a released time religious education program in the schools themselves, in the school buildings.
That's correct.
And so there'd be a half hour, was it, or an hour a week?
It was a little more complicated than that. There was a Catholic elementary school in Champaign, so there were probably a small number of Catholics in the public schools, an even smaller number of Jewish students, and then, of course, the one-size-fit-all Protestant group.
A lot of Protestant Christians, yeah.
And what happened was that the program started out in the junior high, but then they moved year by year down a grade until they got to the fourth grade and ran into my brother. The Protestant class was held the Protestant program was in every classroom. If you were not a Protestant, signed up for the program, then you left. And so the religious class could be held. There was a Jewish class, but it only lasted about 2 years. And all the Jews in the school would leave to go to this Jewish class. And the same was true of the Catholic class. So it kind of disrupted a class three times during the course of a week.
I see. Now your family, and I want to talk about this as accurately as I can, were your mother described herself as a rationalist. And when the suit that she filed against the school board, it included, it was filed on behalf of rationalists, of non-religious people, and of atheists. But, of course, that it was the atheist word that made the headline and caused your family a lot of personal pain and money and grief for years.
It was the A word for sure. I don't think – my mother was really more or less indifferent to religion. If it didn't affect her, she wasn't one to make an issue. My father, raised in the Deep South – where pervades as the most fundamentalist type of religion today existed then, grew up with a very definite, decided dislike of organized religion, certainly that he didn't want his children indoctrinated in it. But when my brother encountered the program, my father was adamant he was not to take it.
I see.
But that left Vashta to deal with it. Her father was, I guess the best way to describe it, is a village atheist of regional repute.
Okay, so you're talking about your mother's father, your grandfather.
My grandfather.
Whose name was called?
He was Arthur G. Cromwell.
Cromwell, yes.
And he figured into the case first by the fact that he had been in Champaign in 1940 when the classes were being organized and attended one of the organizational meetings. And he told the group that what they were doing was unlawful and they shouldn't be doing it. He also wrote a pamphlet, a rather strident pamphlet, I might add. And when my mother's attorney saw this pamphlet, he decided that it would be a good thing to use to try to prove that the classes were sectarian. This was not a general class in religion. They were sectarian classes. Obviously, the A word was the big element that came out of this pamphlet.
Now, your grandfather was proud to be an atheist. In fact, he took this sort of attack on religion as a personal campaign.
I think that's a safe way of putting it. And when the lawyer did his pleading, he included the pamphlet in the pleading. Well, immediately people focused on the pamphlet. And the pamphlet was of course, what I think really brought the atheist element into the equation.
So your mother's case, from her eyes, and the way it was finally adjudicated at the Supreme Court of the United States level, was based on what?
And a violation of the First Amendment as applied to the states through the 14th Amendments. It was the first of a string of cases in which the Supreme Court said that what the local authorities had done constituted an establishment of religion.
So in giving classroom space and classroom time to religious groups to do religious education, the schools, the court judged and in effect been supporting the establishment of religion and of particular religions.
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court, the black wording was support for one religion or all religions. And in this particular case, the school machinery, in addition to the time of the class – the classroom time plus the school facilities, but the involvement of the school staff, which was not emphasized but should have been, also was an element and should have been an element in this case.
Because the school staff would find out from the parents, okay, what religion is your child? Yep. Would you give permission for them to be released to this? All of those things.
A religious census card was distributed.
Yes.
And then you checked which category you fell into, and there were three categories. We were in a fourth.
Now, there was also the issue of the psychological and, in fact, physical harm that your older brother was subject to in being excluded from what the vast majority of students were doing, being made to go to a separate room or sit in the hall in one case, And the fact that the other kids, you know, when they found out that the reason he wasn't doing it was because he didn't believe in God and things like that, they beat up on him in some cases.
It was a difficult time for my older brother. And then, of course, when I came along, I was 2 years behind him, and I entered the same situation because it was still going on when I reached the fourth grade and of course, the classes.
And ultimately, when the trial made the publicity about the case even, as we said earlier, nationwide, your parents decided your older brother needed to be withdrawn from the public schools here. He was sent to his grandfather in Rochester, was it, New York? Where he went into a private school, so the family was having to pay for private school as well as being separated from their oldest son. So the family suffered for this. And at one point, you quote your mother as having written that perhaps if she had known how long this would take, how difficult it would be for the whole family and expensive, she might not have done it. And yet she made the initial choice. She stuck to her beliefs and carried through.
It's an interesting phenomenon. It's like crossing a raging river, and you get out to the middle of the river and you think, gee whiz, I don't think this is a good idea. I think I'll head back to the shore. She got out to the middle of the raging stream and soldiered on. And I think you have the risks of the resulting opprobrium either way. And yet, she fought it through to a successful conclusion, and it was a tough thing. I think she really went back and forth over the years, whether or not she would have done it if she'd known. But I think ultimately she would have done it, and I mean she was just not a person to give up.
Now let's talk a little bit about the books that have come out of this case. There are two primary ones. Your mother wrote a book. Early after the decision, the Supreme Court decision, a couple years afterwards, it was finally published by Doubleday, I believe, originally, then later by Beacon Press, Unitarian Universalist Press. It's a book that's still in print now 60 years after this case, now published by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your mother's book is titled One Woman's Fight. Let me get out all the books, and then we'll talk about each one in turn. You've written a book on this from the perspective of 60 years that's just out this year, and your book is called The Lord Was Not on Trial, and I want to talk with you about that title. This book looks back on and gives sort of the inside story of this whole case and how it all happened and how it felt from the inside of the family. Let me give the phone number so that listeners can ask questions. I've postponed doing that until we got the facts of this case out so that people would know what we're talking about here. But this is a live program here on WILL. We're talking with Daniel McCollum, McCollum, former mayor of the city of Champaign. But since this program is heard pretty widely and particularly over the internet, very widely, just wanted to let people who don't know Dan know how his name is spelled. And his first name is Dannel, officially. Daniel, not Daniel. And we might even talk about that a bit. But for listeners who'd like to join the conversation, the numbers are 217-333-9455. That's if it's a local call, 333-9455. If it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, and we do welcome your calls. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, your mother's book. How did she come to write it?
That book was drafted almost immediately following the Supreme Court decision. But it was 3 years before it finally hit the press. It's a memoir. It's her kind of moving feelings as the case progressed through the court. But the difference between the two books is that rather than a memoir, I tried to go back and pull out the facts from not only my mother's side of the case, but also from the survivors of the school board's side of the case. So it's not written so much from a personal standpoint. It's written from the fact that I had access to a collection of materials that my grandfather had saved because he had participated in the case. And it just seemed to – it just begged to be told. And when I embarked on this, I realized that one of the things that I wanted to avoid was trying to talk about the case from a personal point of view. It was so I think you find it's a fairly objective discussion of what went on.
In fitting with your training as a historian.
Well, I guess. It's an avocation, not a vocation.
Tell us about the title of your book, The Lord Was Not on Trial.
The day the trial began in the Circuit Court of Champaign County, the county courthouse over in Urbana, a young man walked up to the school superintendent, Eugene Mellon, and told Mellon that he had come to testify for the Lord. The superintendent was a tall, courtly man who then indicated to him that he needed to go over and talk to the board's attorney, Mr. Franklin, and motioned the man over to Franklin. And the man came up to Franklin and said that he'd come to testify for the Lord. Franklin was this tall, kind of Lincoln-esque-looking character.
John Franklin, yes.
John Franklin. And Franklin said, the Lord, sir, is not on trial here today, which really pretty much describes the case, not as it was perceived often in the press and in the media, but the real issue.
But that man's wanting to defend God was sort of, I don't know, the emotion of the time. It's hard to remember perhaps for many people today how in the 1940s, during World War II was still going on, the country was very much turned in on itself, and it was very much a Protestant Christian region of the country here. It has been described as the Bible Belt at by some. And some of the articles you quote, the many editorials from papers all over the country, talked about this battle here between what they would often just say is this young, pert, comely young mother who looks as young as a co-ed on the University of Illinois campus, who's taking on fighting against all religion and fighting against God, as the way it was often portrayed in the popular press of the time.
Well, part of that was, in fact, I'd say most of it was due to the approach to the case that the attorney from Chicago had interjected into it. Because my grandfather had also been involved in a similar contest with the New York Board of Education. And I might add that the head of the New York Board of Education was George D. Stoddard. And that should be a familiar name to many people locally.
Who became president of the University of Illinois.
At the time, he was president-elect of the University of Illinois. My grandfather challenged almost an identical system in upstate New York. And it went to the commissioner, and Commissioner Stoddard ruled that it was unlawful. The announcement of his decision broke about the same time that Vashti filed suit. So it was portrayed almost as some sort of family fight against religion.
In the state of New York and the state of Illinois, and here Stoddard was coming to be the president of the University of Illinois in the town where Vashti McCollum had made the suit.
And interestingly enough, there is a chapter on the later problem that Stoddard ran into shortly after the court case was after the trial.
When your mother started to write this book after the successful appeal to the Supreme Court, she had the help of a reporter, right, or a writer, a feature writer from.
She would draft it, and then the feature writer Clarissa Start would meet with her, and they would review the what she had written.
She was from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Yeah. How did they get connected?
They got connected by a feature story that Clarissa Start had done on my mother.
I see. Now the book
and I might add it added a kind of a chatty flavor to her book, which I guess I kind of found a little. I had a problem with because Vashti was a very good writer herself, but it was so different from the style that I would have used and did use that it's kind of an interesting contrast to read both books.
I've not read One Woman's Fight, your mother's book, but you quote from it extensively in yours, so I almost feel like I had, and I'm tempted to go try to find it since it's still in print and read it as well. But at one point, just to give people a flavor of the way the writing came out, at one place you quote that another case was in the public mind here locally, called the Bay Window Case, that had involved a window that projected over a sidewalk and interfered with persons walking by. The window was thus involved in public welfare, just went over the public sidewalk. The question was, had this suit that had just been a decision that had been made just a little time before your mother's suit came to the circuit court, had this suit carried the state official's signature? On this bulging architectural nuisance hung all my hopes, your mother wrote. So she clearly has a sense of humor that comes through in the writing.
Well, it was more a memoir, and interestingly enough, even though I talked to her while I was drafting this manuscript, and again, the manuscript had been pretty much completed 20 years ago.
And your mother died just very recently.
Yeah. And she died in
2 years ago?
In 2006.
Six, okay.
I never really had to interview her because her feelings and so forth, and right at the time, which is the capsule that I wanted to cover, didn't require any more information. It was all in her book.
Let's talk a little bit about the general issue, and perhaps this will stimulate some listeners to call in at our two numbers, 333-9455 locally or long distance. A toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455. You were mayor of this same town that, in a sense, caused your family so much trouble, so many people in this town, so many hostile folks, young people who threw garbage on your front door on Halloween week, many nasty letters, some that your mother couldn't even quote, they were so nasty. From good Christian folks. But what about the issue today? When you were mayor of Champaign and for what, three terms, these kind of issues, what place does religion have, if any, in public life, in public education, in the courts where there's still people are sworn in? They have an option, of course. Do you swear?
Well, I think that the connection with the case has never been a political asset.
Uh-huh.
And to quote Henry Mencken, using a slightly different analogy, but it was a bizarre jest of the gods that I ever became mayor of Champaign.
But what is your opinion about has there been a loss that religion – basically, since your mother's case went to the Supreme Court, has basically not been taught in the public schools. Should there be courses at least about religion?
Well, I don't think it was ever her objection for a survey-type class in religion.
Uh-huh.
But what in fact was in the public schools that she protested against was actually a Sunday school type of
sure.
class. It was simply
indoctrination.
Plain and simple religious indoctrination.
and also with an attempt, perhaps, for evangelization.
The pressure was to take the class.
And sure.
As a matter of fact, to really see how this could be a major problem or create a major problem, one teacher, not particularly sensitive to the problems that could be raised by this, found that there were some of children in her class, not my brother's class, that were not taking the class. So she asked them to stand up and say why they weren't taking the class. And one youngster stood up and said, well, he was Jewish. And by that time, the Jewish class was no longer offered. There were so few of that it was hardly worthwhile doing it. And he got beaten up badly on the way home from school.
Uh-huh.
What it did was separate people out at what we really call the great melting pot of the American democracy, which is public education. It should never have been an issue. It should never have been there. And I think that's the problem, I think, in the way that my mother's attorney handled it, that it was not that it could have been avoided, but that it emphasized this religion versus non-religion issue and not the constitutional principle. And that's why Franklin's comment was so on the money. It was – the Lord wasn't on trial. It was not intended by my mother to be trial of atheism versus religion. As a matter of fact, when my mother was labeled an atheist, she really said that it obviously she was not of of the church persuasion, but it didn't matter to her. It was not a major issue in her life, but it made that as almost a central issue. But she said in court it maybe reflected her actual belief, but it didn't reflect her attitude.
For me, some of the most fascinating sections of your book are the chapters that talk about the actual circuit trial itself, because the questions that were asked of your brother, who was then 10 years old, who was called to the stand and asked, you know, what he thought about these things and, you know, do you believe in God and these kind of questions. All those were open because of the things that were included in the brief. The questions that were asked to your mother, the questions that were asked to the school superintendent. It's fascinating reading. People who like court drama, it really your chapters really reflect the emotions, the feelings, of course, the issues that were on everybody's mind at that time.
Well, of course, it all began with my mother's attorney in presenting the case, did the same thing to the ministers who were responsible for putting at least initiating the program.
Yes.
And so by the time they got around to the defense case, they were ready to catechize my mother the same way,
and
as well as my grandfather.
Right. And so here is the newspapers, as you quote them, describe a sweet little Sunday school teacher, gray-haired lady who was well-educated, a college graduate from University of Illinois, in fact had a master's, but she was primarily a Sunday school teacher. And she's being asked questions by your mother's attorney about what she's teaching and what she believes, and then as you just pointed out, your mother got the same thing in kind. But it makes fascinating reading to see how they were each trying to make their legal points, each attorney.
Well, I think that my mother's attorney, one of the main things he wanted to bring out, which was not easily done, was that the religion classes, particularly the Protestant classes, were divisive to the extent that they raised the issue of the Jews being the killers of Christ. And I think clearly that's what got this young Jewish boy beaten up on the way home from school.
When those kind of issues were discussed in those times, we also need to remember how recently the Scopes trial had been.
Yep.
So in the early 40s, when this was first in circuit court, these were issues that touched many people. And we might mention that this was not just a local program. This release time program for mainly Christian education was in many school districts all over the country.
That's correct.
We have a caller. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on the air with Daniel McCollum, the author of his new book, The Lord Was Not on Trial.
Hi. I have a general comment to make. The Constitution of the United States reads that Congress shall pass no law establishing religion, and then it goes on to, there are two parts, establishing religion, and then it'll make no law to keep anybody from practicing their own religion. But it's the first part I want to focus on here, because it doesn't say that Congress shall make no law establishing this religion or that religion. It doesn't even say Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or any religion. It says Congress shall make no law establishing religion. And that, I have never seen that argument pulled out by people who believe in separation of church and state. Do you know of anybody who suggested that? It seems to me that in times like this, we need a Supreme Court that takes a strict interpretation of the Constitution. And I'll wait for your comment.
The actual wording is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And I think that, of course, that's Congress. Now,
okay.
This was a court case involving what state authorities were doing. But when the Supreme Court had to interpret what the 14th Amendment meant, the Due Process Clause specifically, what it meant, they incorporated the First Amendment of the Constitution as an interpretation of what was meant by the Due Process Clause of the 14th.
Okay, the First Amendment then to the Constitution does not bar the states from establishing religion.
No, it does not.
Ah, interesting.
It was the 14th Amendment, and in particular the Due Process Clause, which is was the connection.
Can you quote that, Dan?
I can't quote it, but in there is the most important language in the 14th Amendment is that you will not be deprived of your rights without due process of law. So it's just known as the Due Process Clause.
Well, I've learned something. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. We're about halfway through our program. Our guest today is Daniel McCollum, McCollum, author of a book describing the inside story of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling that his mother took all the way to the Supreme Court that started here in the circuit courts of Champaign, Illinois. His book is titled The Lord Was Not on Trial, out just this year, published by Americans for Religious Liberty. It's available here locally in Champaign-Urbana, Dan tells me, at both the Jane Addams bookstore and Borders, and can be ordered, of course, elsewhere. His mother's book, One Woman's Fight, is still in print and can be ordered as well. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here from 5 to 6 on Sunday afternoons from WILL AM 580. And also heard online, of course, will.illinois.edu, and then clicking on AM, where our programs are also archived. Support for Keeping the Faith programs have been provided by the University YMCA, where I was a former director and where I'm proud to say Dan McCollum was a former chair of our Board of Governors at one point. Thank him again for his generous volunteer service on that board. One of the Y programs is Know Your University, and a interesting Tuesday program is coming up this November 11th, this coming Tuesday. Jim Nolan, who's a senior fellow at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the university. We'll talk about Illinois politics, what's next. We have many changes, particularly with Barack Obama moving from senator to president, and other changes as well. So Jim Nolan will be speaking at the Y at noon. That's a free lecture in Latzer Hall. The Y is at 1001 South Wright Street on the corner of Wright and Chalmers. If people want to take buses, that's probably the easiest way to get there. Just get off at the University Library stop and walk half a block to the Y. And you can pick up a lunch at the Thai Eatery while you're there, or you may bring your lunch or simply hear the lecture and ask questions. That's Tuesday, noon, November 11th, Jim Nolan. And on Friday at the Y, continuing the program of Real Issues for the Next Administration. Global warming is the topic for November 14 with Michael Schlesinger, professor from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the university. That'll be this Friday noon at the University YMCA on campus. Friday noon, some hard truths you should know about global warming. November 14, this coming Friday at the University Y. Another interfaith program that is featuring a former guest on Keeping the Faith, John Sutherland, a Lutheran pastor who spent the last 2 years in Palestine. If you'd like to meet John personally, hear some of his comments about his experience there. Channing Murray Foundation on campus on Oregon Street, 1209 West Oregon, this coming Wednesday, November 12th in the evening, 7:15, Pastor John Sutherland will be speaking as part of their Social Justice Forum about life and work in Palestine. That's Reverend John Sutherland this Wednesday, November 12th at 7:15 at the Channing Murray Foundation. I might also mention for listeners to Keeping the Faith that I'll be teaching a course next semester as part of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, ALI, on campus, a course on Islam, Multiple Perspectives. I'll be the coordinator, moderator for the course, and local Muslims will be discussing their faith and practice, and we'll be talking about issues of gender and religious conversion and violence and all sorts of issues. We'll be talking about things that are held in common by Jews, Muslims, and Christians, as well as differences. And people who are interested in taking that course, the ALI courses have become very popular in this community, and I'm very pleased to have been invited to teach that course. If you'd like information about that, you can go online and go to ali.uiuc.edu, OLLI.uiuc.edu, and see the description of that course and many others that are offered next semester. Mine will be one day a week, Tuesdays from 3:30 to 5, and they'll start January 27 and go for 8 weeks. They'll be held in Research Park, and for ALI members, the course fee is just $25 for the 8-week course. So if that's something you enjoy doing, please call ALI or check him out online. Well, let's get back to our guest, Dan McCollum, and his experience with this court case. Now, how old were you when the court case happened? Your brother was 10, your older brother.
I was 7 or 8.
7 or 8. And since it took how long to get to the Supreme Court?
It took approximately 2.5 years.
Yeah.
In other words, it had to the you filed filed in June of 1945, and the war was still going on.
Yes.
The trial was September 1945. It was a 3-judge panel that heard the case, a rather unusual procedure, incidentally. The judges ruled against her challenge. It was appealed to the state Supreme Court the next year, and then another unanimous turn down. She appealed it up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and in March 8th, it was a Monday, that's decision day, that's when they announced their decisions, 1948, the case was decided. So this,
and it was 8-1 in her favor at the Supreme Court level.
It was 8-1.
Yeah, very, very decisive. We have another caller, Dan. Let's go to line number one again. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wondered if you might comment on how this case and the experience influenced your own career as a as mayor.
Well, now that's first of all, I'd have to say that the connection with the case has never been a political asset. And it has always come up sometimes on the suggestive level, but sometimes just out and out, bold-faced, in a very out and out bold-faced manner. And it probably was largely responsible when I ran for the state Senate back in 2002 for my defeat. So it's it was a toxic kind of connection for a larger office. I think running in the city of Champaign, where I was well known, had participated in local affairs, that people felt comfortable because they knew me. And of course, I campaigned very hard. But the minute you increase the area in which you are appealing to and people don't know you, it becomes a severe problem. And the opposition when I ran for state senate was circulating in churches over in Vermillion County, telling everybody that I was an atheist. And while I won Champaign County, I lost Vermillion County, and I lost it by a slightly larger margin than the win in Champaign County. So it cost me that election. I will have to say I worked hard to be elected, but that my wife and I decided before the vote I would be better off losing.
Do you want to follow up with that caller?
I have another question about some specifics about your career.
Sure, go right ahead.
Especially, I'm aware that Burnham Hospital, the City Hospital, and Mercy Hospital consolidated during your tenure. I wonder if you could talk about any religious aspects of that and how that may have been worked its way into the decision-making process. I'll hang up and listen.
And for our listeners who may not know the background, Burnham was a city hospital and Mercy a Catholic hospital.
When it became apparent to me that the Burnham board was asking for a city guarantee of $3 million in general obligation bonds, I became very concerned about this, went into the city manager, and I mentioned to the city manager that this was of concern to me, and I asked if it was a concern to him, and he said, well, yes, it was. I decided that looking at the hospital situation had nothing to do with the religious orientation of Mercy Hospital, which was the Catholic hospital. And as a matter of fact, I was born at Carl, so I guess in the sense I wasn't involved with either hospital, either of the two smaller hospitals. But it just occurred to me that the city didn't need to be operating a regional medical facility, and particularly one that was losing losing cases. What happened was that the group practices gradually crowded out the independent doctors who had generally used Burnham. So it was a long, tortuous set of discussions, and everybody who'd ever worked at Burnham, all the people who had their nurses' education at Burnham, stacked up the city hall, meeting after meeting, trying to get the city to hang on to Burnham. It wasn't really a question to me whether Burnham was going to close or not going to close. It was going to close. It was a question of when and how much money the city stood to lose the longer it stayed open. But it was then a question of maybe the two smaller hospitals, Burnham and Mercy, consolidating in some way that would make a viable survivor, because Mercy wasn't doing all that well either. It was clear that there were many procedures, or I should say many, but at least mentionable procedures that violated canon law, and that if there was a consolidation, it would be a very, very difficult to accommodate these procedures.
And the abortion issue was clearly one of those.
No question about that. I really felt that it was more or less a non-issue because there were avenues for abortion procedures where the mother's life or incest, rape were involved that did not have to go to Mercy Hospital or a consolidated hospital. But it was still a very, very long, tortuous negotiation. And finally, it just the city was saying, we are out. The question is, where would it go? Could there be some kind of accommodation with Mercy? And I have to say that I felt pretty comfortable. Well, the first offer was to Christie Clinic, to sell Burnham to Christie. After all, Burnham was a city institution. Christie was a city institution. The council favored a sale to Christie. Christie rejected it. But I had no problem moving in the direction of a consolidation with Mercy. Now, it really wasn't a consolidation. It was really a sale to Mercy. And once the sale had occurred, the more viable entity and the more modern facility, which was Mercy, then became where the hospital operations occurred and Burnham was sold.
And that became Covenant Hospital, now called Provena Covenant.
That is correct.
Right. Okay. What personally did you feel from the effects of this trial, this very famous trial, when you were young?
It's kind of an interesting transition. It was not what I would consider the best thing going for me when I was 9 years old.
Now, your older brother came back after a year away, after the Supreme Court decision, and went into university high school.
That is correct.
But you were still in the public schools younger than that.
That's correct. And it was always a connection that I would rather have avoided. On the other hand, I don't think either my brother or I ever doubted my mother's judgment or my parents' judgment in this issue. But over time, the issue got to be kind of forgotten in a way. It was always in the undercurrent, but it was largely on the surface gone. And it became, when I went into the university, a matter of some mild distinction. But then with the advent of the prayer and the Bible reading cases, which are currently much, much better known than the McCollum case, people have assumed that the McCollum case was the case that decided that issue. Well, it's not true.
It wasn't.
My mother's case was the precedent for it. But, it was the first case where the Supreme Court actually said what the local authorities were doing constituted an establishment of religion. And
the prayer and Bible reading decisions came along later,
in
but
the 60s.
Used your mother's case as precedent.
And so the net result is people began to associate it with that. They confused the cases.
Sure. Now, let's talk a little bit about the support your mother did get from some clergy. Well, at least one clergy. There were, at the time, there was a pastor at the Unitarian Church who was very supportive of your mother and felt that this was an important case that established the separation in the public schools of religion.
His name was Philip Shug. He was the minister at the Unitarian Church on Matthew Street from 1943 to 1947. And he was one of the really true unsung heroes of the case. He was the one who alerted my mother to the possibility that legislation would be passed in Springfield authorizing these kinds of classes. My mother then wrote the three legislators in the area and got back letters which seemed to indicate that they felt that her position was correct
and that they should oppose that legislation.
As she commented in her book, this was a time when legislators probably were sorry that they had ever written anything at all to a constituent that was that specific.
So they wrote to her and said, yeah, we're against it too. We don't think there should be this sort of a law on the books saying that religious groups mm-hmm. should be in the schools.
But also, Shug, after the case, after my mother had decided that she'd had enough, he was the one that had the contacts in Chicago, where actually a group of Jewish businessmen in Chicago called the Chicago Action Council, said that they would handle all legal costs. That didn't handle all the costs of the case for sure, but it certainly made a case possible that our family would have had a great deal of trouble financing.
And so this Unitarian minister had the connections with some Jewish leaders in Chicago who helped fund this, even though the local Jewish community wasn't sure it wanted to be a part of the case because of the attention it would be drawing them, a very distinct minority during the 40s.
There had been for many, many years, in fact, many years, a strong Jewish presence in the business community. And just as in politics, business is equally susceptible to religious bigotry, and they really did not want to jeopardize their standing or their businesses by taking a stand here. It was a lot easier for people in Chicago,
of course,
to back something like this than people in Champaign.
Right. When Reverend Philip, is it pronounced Shug?
Shug.
S-H-U-G.
S-C-H-U-G.
When he took this stand publicly with your mother, and it was a very public stand, he wrote things in his church bulletin, he wrote to the newspapers, he used every means at his disposal to be on her side in a public way, but it cost him too.
It cost him to remember that at the time the Unitarian Church was a very small congregation. Liberal, I think, in the sense, as most Unitarians are perceived to be. But even amongst his own parishioners, this kind of attention was not considered desirable.
Yeah.
But Shug was fearless and very intellectual, very studious type of an individual, and a person who just had a lion heart of courage.
And the support he gave your mother really helped her.
There is no question about it. There were two really unsung heroes. Shug was one, and the other was a Chicago lawyer who was part of the Chicago Action Council, who did a great deal of work in getting the appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. He wasn't as vocal as Shug, of course, but the mechanics of getting an appeal together after an adverse decision in the trial court required generating a transcript of record from which much of the dialogue in the court case was taken that I printed in the book.
What has been the long-term effect of this decision as you look back on the 60 years almost?
It's somewhat disappointing to think that at the time we figured that the rule had been established, that there really was a strong and permanent support for the establishment of religion against the establishment of religion and the First Amendment. But obviously time has eroded this, and I guess the rise of the religious right has been pretty discouraging, and to the extent that it has been so pervasive in national politics, particularly the last 8 years.
When your mother finally got through all of this, you write that she, of course, felt a great sense of relief, but she also wanted to write this book to let the message be known about how it happened. Was she pleased with the response to her book? You quote extensively from very positive reviews of the book all over the country, as well as great attacks on it for people who were still disagreeing with the decision of the Supreme Court.
Well, when Doubleday agreed to take the book, as I indicated earlier, it was generated right after the case, but it did not appear until the early 50s. And my mother felt that Doubleday had second thoughts on it.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, there it was, a finished manuscript. It was published more or less as it had been written, and it never appeared. She kept, I mean, I remember these years vividly. Well, by the time the book came out, it was sort of
old news.
Old news.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it was very disappointing to her, and the book never was a big seller.
But it's been a consistent seller because publishers have kept bringing it out, and as you said, it One Woman's Fight is still in print and available from the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So that must have given her some satisfaction that people were still interested in reading her story.
Well, I have a chapter in there, the last chapter, I believe, that indicates what the follow-up comments have been over the years. And she was interviewed every decade after the decision.
Sure.
And both in the print and the electronic media. And one of the refrains that always came out was she would say, "I knew I was right."
Well, perhaps that's a good place to stop our interview today with Danil McCollum, the author of The Lord Was Not on Trial, an inside story from here in Champaign-Urbana, where it all began, of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling about religion in the public schools from the 1940s. Coming up here on Keeping the Faith next week will be Emily Ward, a poet, talking about her book Shadow Architect. It's written from her Jewish perspective on themes found in the Hebrew alphabet. So, a poet next week, November 16, here on Keeping the Faith. The following week, Professor Deborah Kapp will be talking about worship forms. And from Harvard Divinity School, Matthew Bolton will be talking about worship by phone on November oh, goodness. Well, I can't read my own writing. I guess it's November 30. That makes sense. November 30. So, Jewish-Christian Dialogue will be December 14 with Professor Bob Cathy from Chicago. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I've been delighted to talk with former Mayor Danil McCollum today. Remember, coming up at the Y this week, Tuesday, Illinois Politics, What's Next with Professor Jim Nolan, and coming up November 14, this Friday at Friday Forum, Some Hard Truths You Should Know About Global Warming, and John Sederlin at the Channing Murray Foundation this Wednesday night at 7:15. Well, Dan, again, thanks for being on the program, and sure appreciated it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Plato argued that poets should be banished from the ideal republic. He said poets are only good for promoting petty emotions such as anger and lust and love. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, poetry, with four-time slam poet champion Patricia Smith and Australian poet Les Murray. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7.
At the end of last week, General Motors announced a third-quarter loss of more than $4 billion. Earlier in the week, Ford said it lost almost $3 billion during the same period. The downturn in the economy has brought auto sales to a near standstill and has driven the big three carmakers to Washington in search of help. Monday on Focus 580, we'll look at the current state of the auto industry as we talk with Kim Hill from the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm David Inge, Focus 580, Monday at 10.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS. presenting the host of This American Life, Ira Glass, in an evening entitled Radio Stories and Other Stories on Saturday, December 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets available at 217-206-6160 or online at sangamonauditorium.org.